Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is James Glick, author of Time Travel, A History, published in September by Pantheon. I suppose it could have easily been called Time Travel, A Future, but then this interview would have been done some time ago. Mr. Glick was born in New York City, graduated from Harvard, and worked for years as an editor and reporter for the New York Times. He most recently, prior to this book, wrote The Information, A History, A Theory, A Flood, and before that was Chaos, a great book, a National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize finalist. And he also wrote Genius, The Life and Science of Richard Feynman, My Hero. No, I mean, that's not part of the subtitle, He Is My Hero, and Isaac Newton, which were both shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize, as well as many others, all of which have a spot on my bookshelves at home and at my bookstore. So without time, both the book and the concept, there would be very little to do here in this interview or anywhere. We'd have all the space in the universe and no place to go. Time gives us a chance to be born, to play baseball, to fall in love, to marry, to have children, to watch them grow, to grow old ourselves, to die as we remember chunks of what was a life either well-lived or not. And wouldn't it be nice if we could go back through time and lazily revisit those moments that we hold so dear, or perhaps better yet, scurry back to those moments where we went terribly wrong and perhaps took the road more traveled, and perhaps carefully and with plenty of time untangle what would otherwise be Gordian knots, but with the advantage of slowing things down and letting the gears slip silently backward, are now just slip knots. So, unfortunately, James says we can't do it. But he has provided us with a framework within which we structure our universe and our consciousness. And it's a highway, and he's given us a bit of a roadmap to that highway, and whether or not it's a one-way street or a thoroughfare which can be traversed in one direction only, or both directions. And kind of like as I said, as a spoiler alert, the answer may be no. So this may be a pun-ridden interview, but thanks, James, for taking the time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure. And you can't do it, but you can do it, and we're doing it all the time. So I don't want people to just give up and not try to be time travelers.
Well, I think, and we're traveling now. And the now we just had is gone.
Go ahead. What do you feel a little sense of nostalgia for it already?
Well, it's like we could always just have a short interview and say what supposedly Albert Einstein may have said: the only reason for time is so that everything doesn't happen at once. but there you go. That's a good starting point. How do you differ from that as a somewhat flippant statement?
You know, one of the weird things is how the flippant statements seem to come from great physicists. You know, you think that the people who we've put in charge of telling us what time really is, you know, well, the philosophers used to talk a lot about time, and Shakespeare had a lot to say about time, and psychologists tell us that we measure time in our brains, and there's a lot of variation in how that happens. But the people who are supposed to be the real authorities are the physicists, because it's in their equations, and it's essential, and it's built into the universe. And yet, when you ask a physicist what time is, you get flippant answers like that one. John Archibald Wheeler used to say, time is nature's way of keeping everything from happening all at once. And then he said, well, I read that on the wall of a restroom in a bar in Texas. And Woody Allen said the same thing. And Richard Feynman, your hero, said, time is what happens when nothing else does. And what does he mean by that? I mean, these things sound like jokes.
Well, yeah, and you are flippant yourself. You're even quoting Stephen Wright in your book.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the idea of having amnesia and deja vu at the same time.
That's right. That's Stephen Wright's joke. He thinks he's having amnesia and deja vu at the same time. I feel like I've forgotten this before. There's a lot of wisdom in all of these jokes.
There is, isn't there?
I mean, not to ruin that beautiful little joke by Stephen Wright, but that shows a lot of just to, the fact that we appreciate that shows how sophisticated we are, and we understand that feeling. You know, I mean, there's a little bit of time travel built into that. I should say that the point of my book is that this is new, that we have gotten very smart about time in a way that our ancestors were not. And that's I expect that people listening to us will find that surprising or a statement that they might want to challenge. But before H.G. Wells in 1895, before he wrote his first novel, The Time Machine, there was no such thing as time travel. That Stephen Wright joke would have fallen flat. Well, I don't know how much people talked about deja vu, but there were no time machines. There was no conception of what if I could get on a machine or walk through a magic door or throw a switch and find myself 100 years in the past. Or 100 years in the future, what would that be like? Nobody had that fantasy. Isn't that kind of weird?
Yeah, and it's what's really funny to me is that, you know, you do spend a lot of time with both H.G. Wells and then with Robert Heinlein, a story by his bootstraps, which I read when I was 12 years old, and it completely changed my entire life. And you spend page after page with it, and rightfully so, because it's a stroke of genius, even though he didn't think it was.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I read it when I was a kid, too, and it's a story that he pounded out on a typewriter to make a few bucks, and it's one of the early time travel stories. Kind of part of the story I'm telling is to plot the evolution of these stories and how they get more and more complicated, and the writers discover all of the tricks, and they discover them by necessity. You know, you sit down, you decide you're going to write a story, and in his case, the story involves a guy who has the ability to travel through time through a hole in the air. He doesn't need a time machine anymore. And he asks the question, what if you could meet yourself? Then what happens? And you know, as we would say, hilarity ensues. Bob meets himself, and Bob number two knows what's going on, but Bob number one doesn't know what's going on and doesn't quite recognize himself. And we, the reader, because we're so sophisticated about these time travel stories, we know what's going on before the Bobs do. And by the time we're done, there are five different Bobs, and they are not just having an adventure, not just living through a sort of farce, but they're also exploring philosophical questions of, you know, do they have free will? If they're having a conversation, one of them already had that conversation before. Can he change it? Can he do it differently this time?
It's like when you talk about fatalism or the short story, The Decree, by, and I think it's pronounced Aimé.
I'm not going to attempt to do proper French pronunciation for you.
But the sketch is in the book, too. I mean, you have the sketch of the diagram that Robert Heinlein had to draw, which is essentially a mathematical diagram of all the different Bobs in all their different places, which confuses the heck out of me.
Right. And it's impossible to follow. And it reminded me of the great line in the movie a few years ago, Looper, where Bruce Willis plays a time traveler who has an encounter with his younger self, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And you know, once again, just like in the Heinlein story, Bruce Willis knows what's going on, but Joseph Gordon-Levitt doesn't, because he's meeting his older self for the first time, and he's got a lot of questions, as you might imagine, but the older version is in a big hurry and says, look, we can't sit around and talk about time travel, sure, we're going to be here all afternoon making diagrams with straws.
Yeah, and it's funny because when you talk about, when you get more serious and you talk about the philosophers like Henri Bergson, and you kind of segue from the flippant, the funny, the humorous, to this more serious concept where you get somebody who says ego is the point of consciousness. And I think a lot about that because, just as we were talking about in the beginning today, or maybe before we started, is that the now we just experienced is gone. The now that I just talked about is gone. And is there a point? Is there a point that you can tell me that this is really happening? And it scares the heck out of me.
Yeah, it should. My wife read my manuscript before I turned it in and came back when she was halfway through and said, "You're making my head hurt."
Right.
I shouldn't be advising our listeners who may be thinking about
buying
the book or not getting the book that it's going to make their head hurt.
We're supposed to sell it.
I have thought about bundling it with Tylenol. But because it really is, even though it's a book supposedly about time travel, it got out of control and it couldn't help being a book about time, because the evolution of time travel as an idea in our culture across these last 120 years went hand in hand with all kinds of new thinking about what time really is by the physicists. Einstein was just 10 years after H.G. Wells, and the psychologists and the philosophers and the science fiction pulp writers like Robert Heinlein and the literary fiction writers like Marcel Proust and James Joyce and Virginia Woolf, the early modernists who were obsessed with what, above all, time.
It almost seems, and it's funny because my engineer, who's unflappable and doesn't get excited about anything, is all excited that I'm talking to someone who's written about time travel. And the people people I spoke to, were all excited that I'm interviewing you, but they're all excited about the concept of time travel. And it's just something that fascinates everybody. And when I was a little kid, much like Stephen Hawking and his dinner party, I took a coffee can and I wrote a letter in it and said, "If you discover time travel, please come back to April 14th, 1963 and get me." And then
that's so sweet.
And then I put it in cement and I buried it like 4 feet deep. And I figured that would work. And so then I just stayed there. But no one came.
Well, that's fantastic. So you beat Stephen Hawking.
I did. I didn't know until I read your book
that he had done that. And we should tell people that he sent out an invitation and said, dear time travelers in the future, here's an invitation to a party that I had last Tuesday. And then waited, but there was no time to wait because nobody came. but he already knew that nobody had come. And so he offers that as a sort of proof. Again, an example of a physicist being slightly whimsical, that time travel can't exist.
Well, and this was when I was going to the West Oak Lane Library in Philadelphia, coming home with 13 of Robert Heinlein's books held in my 12-year-old hands and barely able to balance them. And I was so into this that I actually thought, hey, this has a good chance of working.
That's such a wonderful story, and I feel your pain that it didn't work. And when I was working on the book, I ran into a guy who was very excited to talk about time travel. He said, "I have a whole theory. You know how people say time travel doesn't exist because we don't have any time travelers from the future? Well, it's because they're afraid of catching our diseases." And so what I think we should do is set up a quarantine area, disease-free, and publicize it so that the time travelers will have someplace safe to come back to.
They won't figure it out. My thinking at the time and why so much cement was required in depth was because I figured it would probably be about 10,000 years. So I figured I got to put it in something that's going to last long enough, and I wasn't sure it would. And then my excuse for them not showing up was, it must have been dug up in a housing development built or something like that.
And you noticed reading my book that impulse became a sort of fad in the middle of the 20th century, not the inviting of time travelers from the future, but the burying of messages.
Right.
So that we could tell future people what we were going to be about. And even now, there are lots of people who bury time capsules as a kind of message to the future, as a way of having a conversation with our imaginary future selves or our descendants. And it's just a sad fact of the time travel business that a lot more time capsules are buried than ever get dug up.
I know. It's like, and that goes back to ego being the point of consciousness. You know, who thinks that in the future they're going to be interested in seeing, unfortunately, what happened in yesterday's newspapers?
We tend to have better things to do nowadays than go around looking for for our ancestors' time capsules. Because the fact is, they have had other ways of transmitting their culture forward. You know, besides the time capsules, they had museums and libraries and their diaries, and they're all available to us. The time capsules are of course, partly a hedge against the complete collapse of civilization, which may be nearer to us than we thought yesterday.
Maybe we're just all looking for some type of form of immortality, because I remember going to the 1964 World's Fair in New York and looking at the time capsule there, and I know there was one at the 1939 World's Fair, too, and I remember thinking how exciting it was that this wouldn't be opened. It made me feel like, okay, in the year 2400 or whatever, that, you know, that I would actually be a part of it, because, you know what I did when I was little also, was when I would leave, there's a perfect one, elementary school, sixth grade, I was walking home, and I said, I'm going to create a time machine here, and I said, okay, and I stood there, and I said, here's this piece of sidewalk, here's this grass. No matter how old I get, I'll be able to go back to this time and spot. So all through my life, I've created little time wormholes. So I can always go back to that exact spot where I was, when I was, smell it, evoke it.
So. Fantastic. Well, you're right that I do think in the end, time travel is about a kind of longing for immortality, because what's it trying to escape from? It's trying to help us gain some mastery over time. And time is so brutal, and it's a jailer. It imprisons us, and it limits our possibilities, and in the end, it kills us. And so time travel has to be a way of seeking immortality.
The other way when people have a fear of mortality, or when people are ill and... you know, it's funny how when you're young and people say, as long as you have your health, and you don't know what they're talking about, and then when you get older, like you and I think are 2 years apart, I'm 64, I think you're like 62, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So, but when you get older, you realize what that means. but when you're a kid, it doesn't make any sense. The way I look at time, the way I always look at time is that we're swimming through this infinite ocean. It's this dark blue ambient temperature ocean. We've been swimming for all of eternity, and then, like muskrats, we kind of just pop our heads up, look around for like a second, and go, oh, wow, this is interesting, and then you just go back down, and you just keep swimming.
Well, we do have a lot of metaphors for time. That one's
bad. Bad.
That's a new one. I mean, time is also a river. There's the arrow of time. We talk about saving time as though time were a quantity that is perhaps finite, and we can store it up and bank it, or conversely, we can waste it and spend it.
I thanked you at the beginning for taking the time.
That's right. I'm taking some time. You can also take time off. You can watch time pass. Time can fly, but we also feel that we're moving through time, you know, and a lot of these are just linguistic tricks, but a lot of them also correspond to very real impressions we have formed about what time is. And the fact that these impressions are sometimes completely contradictory doesn't necessarily have to bother us, because we can adapt our view of time to suit the occasion.
I like the way that you, in your book, you perforce must go from light in its absolute speed to various metaphors and analogies involving trains, which you've done, which you have to do in all of your books, because everybody who writes popular science has to put a train in the book, and you even mention that in your book.
Really? That's a rule?
I think so.
I'm not aware that there are trains in all my books.
I think there are. Someone's standing on a platform, trains going by. It's either relative motion, one's stationary, one's moving, or one has a clock, and the clock is slower on the
Well, okay, but this is a very specific case. This is Einstein. And it's true that Einstein, who was a master of the thought experiment, did a lot of thought experiments involving trains, because trains were the available technology. I mean, if there had been jet planes flying around in Einstein's time, he might have used planes instead. And perhaps toward the end of his life, he did do thought experiments with planes. But the original thought experiments for relativity naturally used the available technology, and he had trains, and he had electric telegraphs sending impulses and signals and information from one place to another. And he had clocks, electric clocks, that for the first time were being synchronized for the purposes of the railroads. And as a patent clerk, you know, famously, he studied these inventions and was very aware of the various uses that technology was being put to. And so it was natural for him, when he started to think about the physics of time, to use these examples in his imaginative experiments.
Well, you know, I'll bet you that you have a train in every one of your books. I know you have one in Einstein. You have one in this book. I bet you have one in Feynman.
Well, you lose the bet automatically, because there are certainly no trains in my biography of Isaac Newton.
Are you sure? Maybe you just like.
I was very careful to avoid anachronism. He didn't have email either. I mean, actually, to be serious about that for a second, we're supposed to be talking about the time travel book, but
I know.
But
I
was
that.
Very aware when I was writing about Isaac Newton, because it's the only time I have written about. Well, it was the first time I'd written about the fairly distant past, 400 years ago. I was very conscious of anachronism, and I was constantly thinking about the things that we take for granted in our world, both the technologies and the pieces of knowledge that were not available to Newton. And I felt it was essential to subtract that stuff from my mental view of what the world was like. Otherwise, I was not going to be able to understand him. So I guess,
that's hard
I
to
guess
do.
I'm saying that writers have to perform a kind of time travel trick of their own.
Well, do you want to go back to selling your book, the new one?
Okay, sure.
So, I also like the way that you weave in the philosophical aspect of this too, because there's so much of the human in time, and time in us. But for example, I'm going to the symphony on Saturday, Daphnis and Chloe, and I said to someone yesterday that I was going to interview you, and I said, you know, I was thinking, I'll ask him. So I read somewhere you can't hold more than 7 musical notes in your head at one time. And he laughed at me, and he said, no, you can hold the entire symphony in your head at one time. And then I thought, well, at one time, I mean, yes, I'm listening to one piece, and I'm aware of the entire composition, and I know the mood that it makes me feel, but the note just passed. It just passed again. So where did they go that I stored them in some kind of pack? Is it a package wrapped in time? Are the notes resonating somewhere in the now? How does that work?
I think you're asking a very profound question, and it's a question that I feel as it is at the very heart of what music is and how music works. Of all of our art forms, music is the one that operates in time and depends on time. And you can imagine as a thought experiment, this is your friend's thought experiment. Suppose you know a particular piece of music so well as many musicians do, that you simply, you know every note. You know everything that's going to happen from the beginning. A conductor who is very familiar with a piece he's about to conduct often is able to conduct without a score. And some of them, in some cases, know every single note and where it is and when it's going to come and could reproduce the score if they were in a, if they were ordered to with a, you know, pencil and paper. So does that mean that they do have the ability to contain the entire symphony in their heads at one instant? I don't think so. I don't think that's even a meaningful way of understanding how that piece of art works, because the music is something that you experience in time, and part of your experience of the music is a memory of the notes that have come before. And when a phrase repeats itself or varies its previous incarnation, that's the effect of expectation fulfilled or expectation denied, which is at the heart of creating the musical experience. And even if you know a piece of music well, as you're listening to it, you are both remembering the past and anticipating what's still to come.
But it's like, and once again, another one of my heroes, a tragic hero, David Foster Wallace, wrestled and made his head hurt. Even what did he say? It's a real, I can't remember what he said it was. Thompson's arguments, his fatalistic arguments.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to give me a little more.
I can't remember. David Foster Wallace's PhD thesis, or it turned into his PhD thesis, remember? And
yeah.
What was it about? It had, you know, all the O's and the O's with the.
Yes, I know the one you mean. It's his undergraduate thesis in philosophy, and he took on the argument about fatalism. He was very interested in an argument that was raging in philosophical circles about whether you could prove logically that what happens in the future had to happen. Whether it made sense as a logical statement to say there's going to be a sea battle tomorrow. Because either there is or there isn't. And after it happened, you can say, well, there either was or there wasn't. The statement is true or false. So if you make that statement about the future, there's going to be a sea battle tomorrow, is that sentence necessarily either true or false? Or is there a third possibility? Namely, the statement is neither true or false yet because it hasn't happened yet, and either thing can happen. And that's what David Foster Wallace believed, that the future is still open, that it's not determined, and that philosophers who were attempting to prove by logic this argument for determinism were misled by the perfection of their own language.
And it's funny, when I read it, I kept thinking of the tragedy of David Foster Wallace, and it was almost as if his life belied the argument that he was making, because for so long, the path that he ended up taking was a path that almost seemed predetermined both to him and to the people around him. But be that as it may, that doesn't sell your
right
book either.
Or not.
Or what?
Or I would like to think that he was making choices, even if they were terrible choices, and that he had some power over his own life.
But it's, and you know, you even, when you get to the sea battle, you parse it grammatically. You have a section where you actually parse it grammatically and use concepts of the English language and grammar in order to state the premise. And then I was thinking, okay, well, let me think about Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. If I have that book in my head and I can reconstruct him getting in his little skiff and going out to sea, knowing it's his last time, and I can remember how long it takes him to get out there, and then when he catches the marlin, and then when the sharks come and eat the marlin, and then he goes back. I have a pretty good idea of the time it took, and I can kind of feel the time it took. And it's not that what you do is confusing. It's what you do is you give us different ways of looking at time and you do it in kind of a seamless way, so it kind of catches up on you. And you do it scientifically, philosophically, and grammatically, and there's probably a bunch of other ways you do it too. But
well, thank you.
You kind of sideswipe you.
That is what I'm trying to do. And if there are some headaches along the way, it is my hope that when you're done with this journey, as I was, you end up with a richer and fuller understanding of the possibilities of time. Because I think that's what we've all done as beneficiaries of the work of all of these artists who have created various imaginative views of time travel, both literal and figurative.
I mean, just the short list of the people that you draw from Aldous Huxley to H.G. Wells to Stephen Wright to Robert Heinlein to Douglas Hofstadter to David Foster Wallace to Richard Feynman to Stephen Hawking. It's amazing the number of people who have viewpoints that deal with time, and there's scores more that you bring up, from artists to philosophers to scientists. And once again, that turns back to the question I had, and that my engineer reminded me of, is where does this fascination come from? And we spoke a little bit about this intimations of immortality, but there's something else. It's this idea of, I think that there's something magical going on. I think people like the idea of something magical, and time seems magical because it sometimes doesn't seem real. And I think people sometimes equate it with magic. I'm not putting this properly, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because we are able to, we are constructing our own stories as we go along. And when we construct our stories, they have to have a past, and they have to have some expectation or anticipation or even fear of a future. And that's who we are. We're in a way a story that we tell ourselves.
Well, that's very romantic, don't you think?
I don't know. Did you mean that in a good way?
Yeah, in a good way. It's like the Knights of the Round Table or something like that. We're living our stories that we've created ourselves.
We're living our stories and we're writing them. You know, depending on whether you are a believer in fatalism or free will.
Well, that is a kind of by its bootstraps thing, then, isn't it?
Right. I mean, that's why these fantasies are so powerful. They give us a way to explore our regrets and our dreams.
Yeah. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you about this, and I feel
you
much.
You too. Thank you.
I feel much better about things. So that's good. So thank you so much, and especially on such short notice, you know, coming to talk to us today, and I look forward to maybe talking to you again.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was James Gluck. He was talking to us about his book, Time Travel, A History. He's one of my favorite authors, and he writes about my favorite people, whether it's about Isaac Newton or whether it's about Richard Feynman or whether it's about Albert Einstein. And he always draws upon sources that are also my heroes, too. And he writes beautifully, and it's popular science, but it's accessible to everyone, yet it kind of does make your brain hurt, but in a really good way, because you know that you're exercising your brain and you're actually learning and you're being entertained at the same time. And I keep saying time. We must use the word time 100 times, and the book is about time. What happens is when you start talking about it, you realize that your entire life is imbued with this concept that is constantly there. Wouldn't it be nice if, you know, every once in a while, time could let up maybe and stop for a second or two just to give you a breather. But it doesn't. It never stops. And so you only have so many boxes of Q-tips in your life. You only have so many beats of your heart. And there's not going to be a gap period in which you can say, okay, I need to take just a short break. And the seconds as I'm looking at the clock on the monitor, you know, just keep ticking off. The now that I experience at 3:31 is now 3:32 and now 3:33. And that's the way it's going to go. So enough of me babbling on, but in any event, we have all kinds of cool things coming up. I'm really happy about James Quick because really he just was able to do this with one day's notice, and I really appreciate it. And so continue to come by every week. We've had a wonderful year. We're getting to the end of it now. And a plug for the Wellington Square Bookshop. We won Best Bookstore in Philadelphia in Philadelphia Magazine. We won Best Bookstore on the Main Line in Main Line Magazine. We won Best Bookstore in the Daily Local for Out Here. We won bestinphilly.com. Since, unfortunately, Chester County Book Company's closed, we've been able to help a lot of the customers of that store to continue with their book buying fix and a nice place, as they say, a clean, well-lit place to read. You can come by any time, get a cup of coffee, get a pastry, sit in our living room type areas and read. And I won't boot you out unless you're as irritating as I am. And so come by for Christmas. We have all kinds of cool new books, but we also have all kinds of cool new retail things, tons of stuff for kids, tons of gifts. What I've noticed is that lots of times people now will do all their Christmas shopping at our bookstore because you can buy books for almost anybody, your grandfather, your father, your nieces, your grandchildren, your children, and we have books that are perfect for any of them, whether it's from young kids to biographies to histories to military history to fiction to nonfiction to magical realism to poetry to drama to science fiction to fantasy to romance, which I stay away from. Unless I'm interviewing somebody like Gone Girl or Fates and Furies or something like that. But we have everything. And then we have tons of kids' toys, kids' games. We have tons of writing paraphernalia like Lamy pens. We're like exclusive for Lamy pens, which makes wonderful fountain pens, roller balls, regular ballpoint pens. The closest place, I guess, besides us is Chestnut Hill or maybe Doylestown. But we have their complete line of Lamy pens, same pen that Neil Gaiman uses to write his books with. And once you try one, you'll definitely switch to fountain pens. I can guarantee that. And they're very reasonably priced. What else? Tons more stuff. Anyway, enough of that. So thanks so much for joining us today. Thanks so much for supporting us over the past several years and the 400-some authors I've interviewed, including Pulitzer Prize winners and National Book Award winners and authors with as much of an incredible reputation as James Quick has. And it's just been a pleasure for me, and I hope you've enjoyed going along for the ride with me as well, and that you'll be here next week to join us on The Avid Reader.